You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We continue now with author and high school teacher William Rivers Pitt speaking at Boston University.
On January 9th, America threatened Iraq with destruction if it did not leave Kuwait. 3 days later, Congress authorized the use of force against Iraq. 5 days later, the international coalition began a dizzying and deadly aerial assault upon Iraqi forces. For 42 days, they bombed and strafed, sending 2,000 sorties a day against the Iraqi armies and air force. After a month of this punishing assault, President Bush urged the Iraqi people to rise up against Saddam Hussein, whom Bush had publicly compared to Adolf Hitler. No such popular uprising took place. On February 23rd, the ground assault against Iraq began. Ravaged by the air campaign, Iraqi forces fell apart almost immediately, and within 3 days, Iraq announced its withdrawal from Kuwait. On February 28th, Iraq and the United States agreed to a ceasefire. The Gulf War was over. The fighting, however, was not. On March 2, 1991, thousands of Iraqi soldiers were destroyed by the American 24th Mechanized Infantry. Meanwhile, Saddam Hussein remained in power. In fact, American-encouraged rebellions against Hussein were cut off even as they acted. Commanding General Norman Schwarzkopf, Jr., allowed Iraqi helicopters to fly across American lines to attack and destroy rebelling Shiites and Kurds in the north and south. Schwarzkopf also refused to allow Republican Guard units who had risen up against Hussein to reach their stores of weapons. Hussein viciously crushed these insurgents, further solidifying his rule. America had fought a war to remove Hussein from Kuwait, but had made sure in the war's aftermath that Hussein would remain in control. Soon after the end of the war, Saddam Hussein declared victory over the United States. In the aftermath of the war, the economic sanctions against Iraq were held in place. 1.2 million Iraqi civilians have died since from the deprivations created by these sanctions. The United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 687 in April of 1991, creating the Weapons of Mass Destruction Inspection Teams that went under the name UNSCOM, UNSCOM. President Bush was defeated in the presidential election of 92 by William Jefferson Clinton, who continued the Bush policy of containing Iraq. From the end of the Gulf War until today, pinprick attacks by American combat aircraft against Iraqi air defense installations became so regular a practice that they were rarely reported by the American media. Inspection teams methodically located and destroyed all aspects of Iraq's chemical, nuclear, and biological programs until 1998, when a manufactured crisis heralded the removal of the inspection teams by UNSCOM head Richard Butler. Saddam Hussein has been demonized for 12 years by American politicians and the media. He gassed his own people, and America has already fought one war to keep him under control. The presence of weapons inspectors in Iraq was demanded in the first place by Hussein's pursuit of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, along with the ballistic missile technology that could deliver these weapons to all points on the compass. Iraq, of course, had these weapons at one time. The UNSCOM inspector spent 7 years tracking them down. At the outset, the Iraqis lied about having the stuff. They failed to declare the existence of their biological and nuclear programs after the Gulf War and declared less than 50% of their chemical and missile stockpiles. They hid everything as cleverly as they could. After the first lie, the inspectors refused to believe anything else they said. For the next 7 years, they methodically tracked down every bomb, every missile, every factory designed to produce chemical, biological, and nuclear weaponry. They went to Europe and found the manufacturers who sold the equipment. They got the invoices and shoved them into the faces of Iraqi officials. They tracked the shipping of these materials and cross-referenced this data against the invoices. They lifted the foundations of buildings destroyed in the Gulf War to find wrecked research labs and development labs at great risk to their lives and used the reams of paperwork there to cross-reference what they had already cross-referenced. Everything they found was destroyed in place. After a while, the Iraqis figured out that the inspectors were robotically thorough. Fearing military retaliation if they hid anything, the Iraqis instituted a policy of full disclosure. Still, the inspectors believed nothing they said and tracked everything down. By the time they were finished, the UNSCOM investigation had stripped Iraq of 90 to 95% of all their weapons of mass destruction. What of the missing 5 to 10%? The ravages of the Gulf War accounted for a great deal of the missing material, as did the governmental chaos caused by the sanctions. The Iraqis' policy of full disclosure also was of a curious nature that deserved all of the inspectors' mistrust. Fearing the aforementioned attacks, Iraq instituted a policy of destroying whatever the inspectors had not yet found and pretending the stuff never existed in the first place. Scott Ritter, a lead UNSCOM inspector I interviewed for my book, told a story about running down 98 missiles the Iraqis tried to pretend never existed. UNSCOM got hold of the documentation describing them and demanded proof that they had, in fact, been destroyed. Ritter was brought to a field where, according to Iraqi officials, the missiles had been blown up and then buried. At this point, Ritter and his team became forensic archaeologists, digging up every single missile component they could find there. After sifting through the bits and pieces to find parts bearing serial numbers, they went to Russia, who sold Iraq the weapons in the first place. They cross-referenced the serial numbers with the manufacturer's records and confirmed the data with the shipping invoices. When finished, they had accounted for 96 of the 98 missiles. Left over was a pile of metal with no identifying marks, which the Iraqis claimed were the other two missiles. Ritter didn't believe them, but could go no further with the investigation. This story was telling in many ways. Americans mesmerized with stories of lying Iraqis who never told the weapons inspectors the truth about anything should take note of the fact that Ritter was led to exactly the place where the Iraqis themselves had destroyed their weapons without being ordered to. The pile of metal left over from this investigation that could not identify means Iraq technically could not and could never receive 100% confirmation that all its weapons were destroyed. Along with the other mitigating factors described before, it seems clear that 100% compliance under the ONSCOM rules was impossible to achieve. 90-95%, however, is a pretty impressive record. Even if Iraq had somehow managed to hide this vast number of weapons from the inspectors, what they are holding now is nothing more than useless and completely harmless junk. The VX gas was of greater concern. It is harder to manufacture than the others, but once made stable, it can be kept for much longer. The inspectors found the VX manufacturing facility that the Iraqis claimed never existed, totally destroyed, hit by a Gulf War bomb on January 23, 1991. The field where the material they had manufactured was subsequently buried underwent more forensic archaeology to determine that whatever they had made had also been destroyed. All of this, again, was cross-referenced and meticulously researched. The research and development factory is destroyed. The product of that factory is destroyed. The weapons they loaded up have been destroyed. More importantly, the equipment procured from Europe that was going to be used for their large-scale VX nerve agent factory was identified by the inspectors, still sitting in its packaging in 1997, and destroyed. Anything they may have possibly hidden now is garbage, thanks to basic rules of science. Rousing a complacent American populace to support the massive military engagement that would have been required to remove Hussein by force presented insurmountable political obstacles. The tough talk about confronting Hussein continued, but the Bush and Clinton administrations treaded water. This lack of results became exponentially more complicated. Politicians began making a living off demonizing Hussein and lambasting Clinton for failing to have him removed. The roots of our current problem begin to deepen at this point before it became acceptable to encapsulate a nation of 20 million civilians in the guise of one man. Before long, the American people knew the drill. Saddam is an evil threat and must be met with military force, period. In 1998, the Republican-controlled Congress passed the Iraqi Liberation Act. The weight of public American law now demanded the removal of Saddam Hussein. The American government went on to use data gathered by ONSCOM, narrowly meant to pinpoint possible areas of investigation, to choose bombing targets in an operation called Desert Fox. This was in complete violation of the UN charter that had been set up to create ONSCOM in the first place. Confrontation rather than resolution continued to be the rule. By 1998, however, Hussein was still in power. An open letter was written to Bill Clinton in the fall of 1999 condemning him for failing to fully implement the Iraqi Liberation Act. It demanded that he use the American military to facilitate the Iraqi opposition's operations inside Iraq, to put troops on the ground and move on up to Baghdad to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Who signed this letter? Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Armitage, Robert Zoellick, Richard Perle, and several others who have since become part of this new Bush administration. The removal of Saddam Hussein became a plank in the GOP's race for the presidency in 2000. It's in the platform. You can look it up. After gaining office, George W. Bush was confronted with the reality that he and many within the administration had spent a great amount of political capital promising that removal. Once in power, however, he came to realize what his father and Clinton already knew. Talking tough was easy, and instigating pinprick military confrontations was easy. But removing Saddam Hussein from power was not easy at all. His own rhetoric was all around him, however, pushing him into that corner which only had one exit. Still, like the two presidents before him, he treaded water. Then came September 11th. Within days, Bush was on television claiming that the terrorists must have state-sponsored help and that state sponsor must be Iraq. When the anthrax attacks came, Bush blamed Iraq again. Both times he had no basis whatsoever in fact for his claims. The habit of lambasting Iraq and the opportunity to escape the rhetorical box 12 years of hard-talking American policy had created were too juicy to ignore. the dearth of definitive proof of an Iraqi threat against America began to go international. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld appeared before NATO and demanded that they support America's looming Iraq war. Most of the NATO nations appeared ready to do so. They trusted that America's top defense official would not come before them and lie. But when they tried to ask questions of him about the basis for this war, Rumsfeld absolutely refused to answer any of them. Instead, he offered this regarding our utter lack of meaningful data to support a conflict. Quote, "The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence." Scott Ritter appeared before NATO some days after this at their invitation to offer answers to their questions. Much of what he told them mirrors what I've been telling you. After he was finished, 16 of the 19 NATO nations present wrote letters of complaint to the American government about Rumsfeld's comments and about our basis for war. American UN representatives boycotted this hearing and denounced all who gave ear to Scott Ritter. We discussed the domestic political angle that motivates this push. There is, however, another aspect to all this. The other aspect cuts against everything we hold dear and does great damage to this country. No other nation on the face of the earth uses the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as the premise for their foundation in government. America does, and scads of constitutional law have been written and rewritten, debated and considered, because a long time ago the founders decided to base everything upon the absolute necessity of those three concepts. America is and always been a nation of immigrants, because the promise of these simple ideas has lured millions of people from every corner of the globe to these shores. These words are the basis of the American dream, a concept so simple and yet so huge that it's difficult to define. How does one encapsulate the concept of the pursuit of happiness in so diverse a nation? The answer to that question lies in your interpretation of the world that comes before it, liberty. Above all and first in line is life. Americans have the right to be alive, free, and to pursue fulfillment in whatever way suits them, so long as that pursuit does not grossly interfere with the life, freedom, and happiness of a neighbor. The American dream has come to mean a variety of things pertaining to ownership. Having your own home is part of the American dream, as is owning a car, having a job, and the pursuit of monetary wealth. This is all well and good, for we live in a capitalist society so large that it would make Adam Smith faint. Through it all, however, runs the pulsing heartbeat of those three simple concepts. Of course, we have never achieved these lofty goals set by the founders in this regard. Liberty is still denied to many, and the pursuit of happiness is impossible for citizens treated unequally. Yet the American dream, at bottom, is bent towards the creation of that more perfect union, where wrongs are made right and happiness is well within reach. This is the American dream we speak of openly, in daylight, when the children gather to learn about the land they call home. This is what we tell the immigrants when they raise their hand to take the pledge and become citizens. This is what we tell ourselves when we feel the need to be convinced that this nation is indeed good and great. There is another American dream, which lurks in shadow and speaks only in whispers of its designs. It works at all hours of the day and night to achieve its goals. It does not sleep. The existence of this other American dream places the first one, the real one, the true one, in terrible peril. If this other American dream is allowed to blossom into its intended potential, the American dream we speak of to our children will cease completely to exist. The proponents of this other American dream look at the world in terms of empire. They seek to achieve hegemony over great swaths of strategically important territory and will do whatever is necessary to gain this control. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, they see America as the first truly global superpower. With the use of economic and military might, they seek to gain absolute dominion in the space opened by the fall of our former rival. The term globalization encapsulates only a fraction of this idea. For many years, the proponents of this other American dream lingered in neoconservative think tanks like the Committee on the Present Danger, where they could only snipe from the fringes. With the rise to power of George W. Bush in an election that denied him even the pretense of a mandate, these neoconservative strategists suddenly found themselves walking the halls of power because Bush was forced in the absence of that mandate to fall back upon his neoconservative base for support. The other American dream, alive for so long only in white papers within these think tanks, has become the central framework of American policy. One proponent of this strategy is Richard Perle, a former Defense Department official within the Reagan administration. Perle is now chairman of the powerful Defense Policy Board, which carries great weight within the Pentagon. Recently, this board listened with avid attention to a policy briefing proffered by another hard-right think tank from the RAND Corporation that proposed a, quote, grand strategy for the Middle East. The final slide of their presentation offered, quote, Iraq as the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia as the strategic pivot, and Egypt as the prize, in an effort to extend American hegemony over the entire Middle East. The framework for this other American dream has other champions in positions of great influence within the Bush administration. Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld and his assistant Paul Wolfowitz spring from the same neoconservative think tank roots as Richard Perle. From their places high in government, these fringe elements have gained the required position to push forward with their plans. This other American dream is not solely a creation of the Bush administration, nor has it just recently come to fruition, nor is it fixated solely upon the Middle East. The bloody history of Afghanistan represents a clear example of the kind of geopolitical gamesmanship that characterizes the plans these people have for America. Afghanistan in 1978 was ruled by a communist puppet regime called the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, the PDPA. To foster a destabilization of that regime so as to counter the growing Soviet influence in that strategically vital region, America began arming and training Afghan Mujahideen warriors with Pakistan's assistance in an effort to undermine the PDPA. This effort, however, had more in mind than the overthrow of the PDPA. Eli Krakowski, in a study written for the Institute for Advanced Strategic and Political Studies in April of 2000, described Afghanistan's importance as going far beyond the dictates of the Cold War. Quote, Afghanistan owes its importance to the location at the confluence of major routes. A boundary between land power and sea power, it is the meeting point between opposing forces larger than itself. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, it has become an important potential opening to the sea for the landlocked new states of Central Asia. The presence of large oil and gas deposits in that area has attracted countries and multinational corporations. Because Afghanistan is a major strategic pivot, what happens there affects the world. Unquote. This places America's aid to the Mujahideen in 1978 in a broader perspective. Our actions were not simply about attacking communism. In attempting to destabilize the PDPA, we were hoping to tempt the wrath of the Soviet Union. It worked. The Soviet Union invaded and eventually destroyed its ability to extend influence into the region against the unyielding rock of Afghanistan, eliminating a strategic enemy and opening the region to broadening American control. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor for President Carter during this period, bluntly confirmed this in 1998. Quote, we did not push the Russians into invading, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. The secret operation was an excellent idea. The effect was to draw the Russians into the Afghan trap. Brzezinski's brag is revelatory, for it describes the lengths to which the proponents of this other American dream will go to achieve this goal. Afghanistan was utterly destroyed by the Soviet invasion in 1979, by the 10-year war fought by Afghan warriors to remove them, and by the ravaging civil war that descended in the aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal. In that span was born the Taliban, trained to fight and to propound their deadly interpretation of Islam in Pakistani religious schools funded and supported by the American CIA. Brzezinski's Afghan trap gave birth as well to Osama bin Laden, whose reputation as a heroic anti-Soviet Mujahideen warrior made him a demigod within Afghanistan. None of this, the Soviet invasion, the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, the wretchedness of life in Afghanistan, would have come into existence without the forces behind the other American dream playing out these geopolitical strategies that do not consider the after effects of their actions. This other American dream was codified by Brzezinski in 1998, who authored in that year a study for the Council on Foreign Relations entitled The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. The study described in detail the importance of Afghanistan and the entire Central Asian region, which is described in this report as Eurasia. According to the study, America must gain military and economic control of the region to stave off competition from China, Russia, and Europe. And I quote now the guts of that study. Quote, but the Eurasian Balkans are infinitely more important as a potential economic prize. An enormous concentration of natural gas and oil reserves is located in the region, in addition to important minerals including gold. It is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also of challenging America. A power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions. To put it in terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. Profoundly disquieting are the conclusions reached by Brzezinski regarding the means by which the American populace could be directed into supporting the actions required to achieve control in that region. Quote, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. The danger is clear. The geopolitical strategy of dominion in Central Asia, begun in 1978 with the Afghan trap, put in motion a series of events that ultimately led to the creation of the Taliban, the empowerment of Osama bin Laden, and the attacks of September 11th. The plans described to Richard Perle's Defense Policy Board that target not only Iraq, but Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and indeed the entire Middle East were born from these same strategic imperatives. This is the other American dream. Already the blowback from its dictates have dealt a terrible blow to the true dream we wish to live by. We live in fear now of mega-terrorism that was spawned by our actions in Central Asia and the Middle East and by our own desire for economic control of those regions and their resources. Because of the terrorism we have already endured, many of our essential liberties have been taken away in the blasphemous guise of protecting freedom. Because of the terrorism we have already endured, the fundamental right to life was taken from thousands of our citizens. The three pillars of our society have been shattered. The proponents of this other American dream control the military, economic, and strategic policy that governs this nation. Their power was greatly increased by a terrorist attack put in motion by the activities of other American officials acting with the same strategy of hegemony and dominion in mind. They continue their work right now at this moment. Nothing they are doing has your best interest, safety, or security in mind. The resolution for war on Iraq Bush first pushed on Congress spoke of making war on, quote, the region, not just Iraq, thus giving him legal cover for total war upon the entire Middle East. This is the passionate dream of those extreme neoconservative hawks within the Bush administration who are actually running American foreign policy in the war on terror. Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney. That resolution for war had the region redacted from the text because it was nothing more or less than a legal blessing to extend eternal war across the planet. They want war over there, and they will have it, regardless of the facts and the dangers that argue against it. The results of this, I fear, will be catastrophic for this country, for the world, and for each and every one of you.
William Rivers Pitt is co-author with former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter of War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. His speech at Boston University was recorded by Mark Weaver of community radio station WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts. On a final note tonight, this is our last week of regular programming here at Peace Watch. We've thoroughly enjoyed producing this show over the past year, and we thank all of our listeners and supporters for their generous feedback and support, monetary and otherwise, which kept us going for so long. Our staff is entering planning and production for a brand new show with a broader focus to be launched November 3rd on most Pacifica stations and affiliates. Stay tuned for further information and broadcast times. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini, Yolanda Turner, and Ellie Walton. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.